It's almost 6 a.m. in London, and the invasion news reaching here is still favorable. The weather in the Channel still leaves much to be desired, but it's believed that reinforcements are continuing to flow across the France without interruption. The live commanders are optimistic, and the German radio still is making no attempt to disguise the magnitude of the Allied attack. All has gone well on D-Day. The liberation of Europe is not being accomplished by robots. The story of the second front is the story of your son, your kid brother, and of men whose personalities and achievements have commanded the headlines. From commanders down to buck privates, the Allied invasion army is a human army. General Montgomery was beaming today, not only because he was proud to have been officially revealed as the Allied invasion commander, but also because he had been given a new battle dress and a new watch by the American army. The invasion troops were proud that they had been selected for participation in the greatest show on earth, although they fully realized that they weren't in for any picnic. A veteran of Dunkirk cried, and admitted he cried, when he threw his Spitfire over the French coast to help his earth and sea-bound buddies take the road back. A French pilot was thrilled at the sight of his homeland, even though he had to drop bombs on it, because he said it meant that he was on his way home. General Montgomery said he was happy to be the Allied assault commander because I always get along well with Americans. As proof that he gets along well with our folks, he drew attention to his new battle dress, the finest suit I ever had, and his new watch, a good one which keeps time. General Montgomery has been confident all day long, but he warned that there may be a bit of a roughhouse before we are finished. Montgomery's boss, General Eisenhower, also impressed correspondents with his confidence. But the greatest impression he made came from his visits to his troops just before each hour and the informal way he talked with the soldiers. He asked the members of one airborne outfit who was their toughest soldier. One GI answered, "Wait until we land and then we'll find out." The general asked the outfit to send their champion back to him and he'd have something for him. But today was not a general's day. It was the GI's and the junior officers' day. The generals had done everything they could. Success of the initial operations depended on the GIs and the shave tails who led them. It depended on the sailors and coast guardsmen who manned the invasion craft and the warships. There were admirals at sea today also, but the execution of their orders depended on the gradeless boys. The air marshals and generals had mapped out the air phase of the invasion. The kids I used to know at Kelly Field in San Antonio, among others, were the ones who made it succeed. And the story of this war can't be told properly until the story of certain civilians is told, such as those inside France who have been awaiting and fighting for liberation these last 4 years. Not much is known about what the French people have done to help the invasion so far. A good guess is that they're doing plenty. At least it's clear what side they're on. 9th Air Force flyers returned to England this afternoon to tell how French farmers and their families waved eagerly to the Allied flyers as they rounded up farming animals and herded them to places of safety. Today's story must include mention of that prototype of John Bull, Winston Churchill, who set the House of Commons cheering with his optimistic reports on the invasion's progress. It must include mention of Britain's King George, who unashamedly called his people to prayer. There was General Charles de Gaulle, one of the few important Frenchmen who wouldn't concede French defeat in his country's darkest hour, and who now is in England to watch the beginning of his homeland's liberation. But the important guys today were the G.I. Joes and their buddies on the sea and in the air, wearing the uniforms of America, Britain, and the countries which Hitler once foolishly thought he had conquered. And today's story must include mention of the people on this island, those people who were pledged by their prime minister 4 years ago last Sunday to fight on the beaches and the landing grounds and in the streets, but never surrender. They took today's news phlegmatically, but that's no criticism. The British people are by nature calm and rather sober-minded. Their coolness was one big reason that they stood while other nations were falling in 1940. And their ordeals in this war have been all the more sobering. They're tired, and tired people don't dance in the streets, even on D-Day. They probably won't even dance in the streets on Armistice Day. I studied the people of London both before and after the landings in France had been announced. The first glimpse was after Ed Murrow had phoned me and told me to get to such and such a building as soon as possible. I was positive immediately that D-Day had dawned, because the building to which Ed dispatched me was the building from which the big communique was to be issued. I set out as London was going to work, and the crowds I weaved through were composed of shop girls, businessmen, and a few whose garb suggested manual labor. They looked like just about any going-to-work crowd any place in the world. Pittsburgh, Chicago, San Francisco. Some looked sleepy, some were quite brisk. Some were neatly dressed, and some were otherwise. There were white-lipped girls who apparently had got up too late to put on lipstick and intended to do so at their offices or shops. But the clothes they wore neatly or carelessly were of 1939 and 1940 vintage. The lipsticks the girls wore or neglected to wear was a hard, almost chalky substance, war stuff. And those who looked tired weren't suffering from lack of a full night's sleep. They reflected almost 5 years of late in the front lines of war. I felt like yelling out, "It's happened. We've invaded Europe." Because what was started today is what these people have been working and fighting for since the bedraggled fugitives from Dunkirk staggered back to their homes 4 years ago this week. 3 or 4 hours later, when I went out into the streets of London again, I learned how the people would have reacted had I spilled the big secret with which I was bursting. They would have said, as many did say to me after communique number one had been broadcast, "That's good." And they would have said it, as they did say it later, very calmly and matter-of-factly. They wouldn't have appeared jubilant, but as a policeman said to me tonight, they were jubilant inside. I return you now to CBS in New York.